I want to encourage everybody, radio is terrible to watch. So if you have, if you knit, or I'm not sure what you're doing, Rebecca.
Or something,
please bring that to these. You could run out and grab it now and come back. Much of radio is meant, well, all of radio is meant to be listened to while you're doing something else. So you're waking up in the morning, you're brushing your teeth, you're driving to work, you're driving home from work, you're making dinner, you're getting the kids ready. So radio is not meant to be looked at, and it's certainly not meant to be the only thing you're doing at any one time. So my job, your job is not to listen to the radio. My job is to make radio that's interesting enough to distract you from the other things that you're doing. And so the rules that I keep in my mind when I'm editing is that nobody has to listen to us and there's no quiz at the end. So keep that in mind tonight. You don't have to listen and there's no quiz at the end. I'm going to play some excerpts of some of my favorite oral histories that NPR has broadcast over the last few years. But I wanted to start by reading, I made a couple of copies if people want them afterwards. It's from a new book. I think it's either just come out or it's about to come out. But I got galleys of it a few months ago. It's a letter, the book is called Take My Advice, Letters to the Next Generation from People Who Know a Thing or Two. And one of my favorite philosophers, Martha Nussbaum, wrote one of the letters in this. So I'm just going to read this to you. I'm going to play the first three pieces, and the first three pieces are all about each other. So let me read this to you. This is Martha Nussbaum writing to a young people. Do not despise your inner world. That is the first, most general piece of advice I would offer. Our society is very outward-looking, very taken with the latest new object, the latest piece of gossip, the latest opportunity for self-assertion and status. But we all begin our lives as helpless babies, dependent on others for comfort, food, and survival. And even though we develop a degree of mastery and independence, we always remain alarmingly weak and incomplete, dependent on others and on an uncertain world for whatever we are able to achieve. As we grow, we all develop a wide range of emotions responding to this predicament, fear that bad things will happen, and that we will be powerless to ward them off. Love for those who help and support us. Grief when a loved one is lost. Hope for good things in the future. Anger when someone else damages something we care about. Our emotional life maps our incompleteness. A creature without any needs would never have reasons for fear or grief, but also not for hope or joy. But for that very reason, we are often ashamed of our emotions and our stories and of the relations of need and dependency bound up with them. And then I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. What is the remedy of these ills? A kind of self-love that does not shrink from the needy and the incomplete parts of our stories and ourselves, but accepts those with interest and curiosity, and tries to develop a language with which to talk about needs and feelings. Storytelling plays a big role in this process of development. As we tell stories about the lives of others, we learn how to imagine what another creature might feel in response to various events. At the same time, we identify with the other creature and learn something about ourselves. As we grow older, we encounter more and more complex stories in literature, in film, in visual art, in music, I would add on the radio, that give us richer and more subtle grasps of human emotions and of our own inner world. So my second piece of advice, closely related to the first, is this. Read a lot of stories, listen to a lot of music, and think about what the stories you encounter mean for your own life and the lives of those you love. In that way, you will not be alone with an empty self. You will have a newly rich inner life with yourself and enhanced possibilities for real relationships with others. So that, again, is from Take My Advice, Letters to the Next Generation from People Who Know a Thing or Two. And that's either just come out or about to come out. And that's the letter from Martha Nussbaum. So I want to start by playing some oral histories that we've been broadcasting on Morning Edition for the past 8 or 9 years. It's from the StoryCorps project. And what I'm going to do is play 3 StoryCorps in a row that are all related to each other, and I'll let them explain themselves to you other than that.
In Manhattan's Grand Central Terminal, there's a soundproof booth where people sit down and record their personal stories. And from time to time, we get to listen in. The project is called StoryCorps. And it was created by independent radio producer Dave Isay. We've heard the stories of all kinds of people. And today we spend a few moments with Danny and Annie Parasa. They came to the StoryCorps booth to talk about being married and their momentous first date. It happened on this day, 27 years ago.
She started to talk and I said, listen, I'm going to deliver a speech. I said, Danny, you're going to want to go home. I said, you represent a 34-letter word. I said, that word is love. I said, if we're going anywhere, we're going down the aisle because I'm too tired, too sick, and too sore to do any other band. And she turned around and she said, well, of course I'm married. And the next morning I called her as early as I possibly could.
And he always gets up early.
To make sure she hadn't changed her mind, and she hadn't. You see, the thing with it is, I always feel guilty when I say I love you to you, and I say it so often. I say it to remind you that as dumpy as I am, it's coming from me. It's like hearing a beautiful song from a busted old radio. And it's nice you to keep the radio around the house.
If I don't have a note on the kitchen table, I think there's something wrong. You write a love letter to me.
Well, you know, it could possibly be wrong is I couldn't find a silver pen.
To my princess, the weather out today is extremely rainy. I'll call you at 11:20 in the morning.
It's a romantic letter.
And I love you.
When a guy is happily married, no matter what happens at work, no matter what happens the rest of the day, there's a shelter when you get home. There's a knowledge, knowing that you can hug somebody without them falling downstairs and saying, get your hands off. Being married is like having a color inside. You never want to go back to black and white.
The personal voices of Danny and Annie Parasa as recorded in the StoryCorps booth in New York City's Grand Central Terminal. The StoryCorps recordings are being archived at the Library of Congress. If you want to hear other excerpts or learn more about the project, visit npr.org. This is Friday morning, which means it's time to bring the StoryCorps, the project that gives everyday people the chance to interview one another about their lives. These recordings become part of the collection of the Library of Congress, which is growing into an oral history of America. Today we'll check back in with a memorable couple whose story was first broadcast on our air 2 years ago. Their story captivated many listeners, and also StoryCorps creator, Dave Isay.
Danny Parasa is a horse betting clerk in New York City. His wife, Annie, is a nurse. They first visited the StoryCorps booth in Grand Central Terminal in January 2004 to tell the story of their very first date.
She started to talk, and I said, listen, I'm going to deliver a speech. I said, Danny, you're going to want to go home. I said, you represent a 34-letter word. I said, that word is love. I said, if we're going anywhere, we're going down the aisle because I'm too tired, too sick, and too sore to do any other dancing. And she turned around and she said, well, of course I'm married. And the next morning I called her as early as I possibly could.
And he always gets up early.
I made sure she hadn't changed her mind, and she hadn't. And every year on April 22nd, around 3 o'clock, I call her and ask her if it was today, would she do it again? And so far, the answer's been the same.
Yeah, 25 times, yes.
You see, the thing of it is, I always feel guilty when I say I love you to you, and I say it so often. I say it to remind you that as dumpy as I am, it's coming from me. It's like hearing a beautiful song from a busted old radio. And it's nice you to keep the radio around the house.
If I don't have a note on the kitchen table, I think there's something wrong. You write a love letter to me.
Well, you know, it could possibly be wrong if I couldn't find a silver pen.
To my princess, the weather out today is extremely rainy. I'll call you at 11:20 in the morning.
It's a romantic weather.
And I love you. I love you. I love you.
When a guy is happily married, no matter what happens at work, no matter what happens the rest of the day, there's a shelter when you get home. There's a knowledge, knowing that you can hug somebody without them falling downstairs and saying, get your hands off me. And being married is like having a color television set. You never want to go back to black and white.
That story was the beginning of a love affair between Danny and Annie and StoryCorps. After that first interview, Danny returned to the booth many times to talk about his love for Annie. Over time, Danny and Annie became something of the public face of StoryCorps, sought after for interviews in the newspapers and on TV, eventually traveling the country talking about the project. Our motto is, listening is an act of love, and Danny and Annie came to personify StoryCorps, the eloquence, grace, power, and poetry in the words of people you might not notice walking down the street. Danny falls squarely into that category, a bald gnome of a man with a near toothless grin. But 1 minute in his presence, and there's no doubt that Danny Perasso radiates more romance and authenticity than all of Hollywood's leading men put together. Last month, Danny Perasso was diagnosed with a fast-spreading terminal cancer. Although his cancer is particularly painful, he wanted to talk one more time about his feelings for Annie. So last week, StoryCorps went to Danny and Annie to record them in their home in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. Danny spoke lying down on a couch. Beside him in a chair was his wife, Annie.
The illness is not hard on me. It's just, you know, the finality of it. And then he goes along like a trooper.
Listen, even downhill, a car doesn't roll unless it's pushed. And you're giving me a great push. The deal is, we try to give each other hope, and not hope that I'll live, hope that she'll do well after I pass, hope that people will support her. Hope that she meets somebody in life and she marries him.
Yeah, he has everything planned.
I'm working on it. She said it was her call. She wants to walk out behind the casket alone. I guess that's the way to do it, because when we were married, you know how your brother takes you down, your father takes you down? She said, well, I don't know which of my brothers to walk in with. I don't want to offend anybody. I said, I got it to lose. I said, you walk in with me, you walk out with me. And the other day, I said, who's going to walk down the aisle with you behind the casket? You know, to support. And she said, nobody. I walked in with you alone, walking out with you alone. There's a thing in life where you have to come to terms with dying. Well, I don't come to terms with dying. I want to come to terms with being sure that you understand that my love for you up to this point was as much as it could be, and will be as much as it could be for eternity. I always said the only thing I have to give you is a poor gift, and it's myself. And I always did. And if there's a way to come back and give it, I'll do that too. You have the Valentine's Day letter there?
Yes. My dearest wife, this is a very special day. It is a day on which we share our love, which still grows after all these years. Now that love is being used by us to sustain us through these hard times. All my love, all my days, and more. Happy Valentine's Day.
I could write her an order about her. She lights up the room in the morning when she tells me to put both hands on her shoulders so she can support me. She lights up my life when she says to me at night, wouldn't you like a little ice cream? Or would you please drink more water? I mean, those aren't very romantic things to say, but they stir my heart. In my mind, in my heart, there has never been, there is not now, and never will be another day.
We'd like you to know that earlier this month, the flagship StoryCorps booth, which is in New York City, was dedicated to Danny and Annie Perasso. If you'd like to see pictures from that dedication, as well as wedding photos and additional stories, go to NPR.org.
StoryCorps is made possible by a grant from Saturn.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Stephen Skeeper. Many of our listeners. first met Danny Ferrassa and his wife Annie Ferrassa when they interviewed each other for Story Tour. That's the project that gives everyday people the chance to interview one another, adding to an oral history of America at the Library of Congress. Here's part of the story we heard from them 2 years ago.
I always feel guilty when I say I love you to you, and I say it so often. I say it to remind you that as dumpy as I am, it's coming from me. It's like hearing a beautiful song from a busted old radio. And it's nice of you to keep the radio around the house.
If I don't have a note on the kitchen table, I think there's something wrong. You write a love letter to me.
Well, the only thing that could possibly be wrong is I couldn't find a silver pen.
Danny Ferrassa. He recently learned that he was dying of cancer, and last Friday the Ferrassas returned to this program to talk about it. Hundreds of you wrote in to express your sympathy and your appreciation. That afternoon, even as some of those letters were read to Annie, Danny died. He was 68 years old. Danny Ferrassa will be buried today, and some of your letters will be read at the funeral. We'd like to share a few of them here.
Maria Yvette Barraza wrote from El Paso, Texas, to tell Danny and Annie, your voices have touched a lot of hearts. Your story gives us real hope of real love between real people. I can go back home and tell my kids, look, listen, your life will be like this.
Dan Brown writes, my wife and I just celebrated our 25th anniversary. Actually, celebrated is an overstatement. We're having a tough time right now. In fact, I was sitting here considering a separation. I was going to leave today. But then I heard you guys on the radio, and I'm crying in my office, happy for the gift of my wife and happy for the slight glimpse of hope you've given me. I'm going home tonight. From the bottom of my heart, thanks.
Kate Wright of Pennsylvania sent this email. Listening to the words of people who are completely unafraid to love each other gave me a feeling of hope.
I am in your debt, writes Dick Ziegler of Wichita, Kansas. I just finished listening to the continuation of your love affair with each other and with life. Since your story has been assured longevity by placement in the Library of Congress, future generations who pay attention to the nature of humankind will be afforded the opportunity to learn from your love. You will be in my thoughts and prayers, not as strangers, but as travelers who are battling life's dragons with humor, love, and an unquestioning bond of togetherness.
Those are some of the letters sent to Danny and Annie Ferrassa. Danny Ferrassa will be buried today in Brooklyn. If you'd like to send a note of condolence to Annie Ferrassa and read listeners' reactions to their story, go to NPR.org.
And we'll leave you with part of the final interview Danny and Annie Ferrassa conducted together.
She lights up the room in the morning when she tells me to put both hands on her shoulders so she can support me. She lights up my life when she says to me at night, wouldn't you like a little ice cream? Or would you please drink more water? I mean, that's all I'm very romantic things to say, but they stir my heart. In my mind, in my heart, there has never been, there is not now, and there will never be another day.
Music after pieces to give you a chance to just think about them and reflect on them. The part of the story that isn't on here and that wasn't broadcast is that after these letters aired, about 25,000 listeners wrote in to Annie. And she opens one of those letters every day and reads it in place of the letter that Danny used to write and leave on the table. That's why I work in public radio. So I wanted to just, you know, have some time for you, anybody who wanted to talk a little bit about what, you know, I wanted to play all three in a row because you got to hear the story, parts of the story several times over and over again. Maybe some parts were difficult to understand the first time, you can understand that a second time, but the third time, each of those aired, you know, some time apart, the first two years apart, the next one a week apart. But if you have a chance, on YouTube, this story has been animated. and we had an animation artist do illustrate this. So go on YouTube sometime when you're not up here and can actually get good YouTube access and watch their story. It's very sweet. So I wanted to ask you, what parts of this were memorable for you, and what parts of it do you think maybe were too personal to put on the radio? We get a lot of criticism for StoryCorps for putting things that are too personal on the radio.
I can just say it's why I listen to public radio. I heard those stories as they were happening, and I also have seen the animation.
Oh, yeah, good.
And I when I saw it and heard it, it was like, oh, I love public radio. Yeah.
People either love it or hate it. Nobody's neutral. They know about it.
It's a gift to be able to speak from the heart to a broad audience.
I mean, the conceit of StoryCorps is that it's family members or friends, loved ones, asking questions of each other, and not just, me as the cold and often quite calculating interviewer asking people questions. Later in the week, I'll play some of those more calculated questions for you, and I'm going to give you some things to read that talk about the different ways that we formulate questions and why we ask questions. But the great thing about the StoryCorps project has been that, every Friday at 7:20, or I guess it's 6:25 a.m. on the East Coast, different in different time zones, there's this little 3 minutes or 4 minutes that isn't Syria, and it isn't Egypt, and it isn't Congress deadlocked, and it isn't a hurricane. It is just some people, some real human beings talking to each other. But what's been surprising in the whole StoryCorps process is that we now have, tens of thousands of these interviews, is that quite often they do link up very nicely with the news. And I'm going to play one in a minute that actually this news sort of happened, I think, on a Monday or Tuesday, or maybe it was the week before, and then we happened to have a StoryCorps that related to it. But they're very well indexed, which requires somebody to listen through, transcribe, and index them so that when we look up, dying of cancer, we can find that really easily.
So how many of these stories do you get? I mean, when you're talking about somebody having to listen to them and index them, how many do you get a week or a day or whatever?
Well, in Grand Central Station, there is a StoryCorps booth, as you heard Stephen keep say. And then there are a bunch of mobile booths. They're Airstream trailers that say StoryCorps on the side, and they drive around the country. Public radio stations around the country can invite them to come and sit out in front of their studios. In Chicago a few years ago, they parked it on the front steps of the Field Museum, and people could go there and sign up for a time to do interviews. I think you can get 15 minutes at a time in there. They give you some question prompts. I brought the question prompts that if you want to take a look at. I think there are half a dozen of these mobile booths that make their way around the country. The main one is in Grand Central Station. I heard that you did one last summer, was it? You did sort of an impromptu one here?
And yes. Taylor.
Yeah, so this was the 50th summer, as I understand
right,
it.
And so it's your job to listen to an index 80 hours in a
year. Yes. Put it in text, yes.
We pay transcriptionists to do it for us. We're not doing it ourselves.
Yes. Welcome to my life.
One day on the job and he's already griping.
I went fishing.
Well, I wanted to play, I'm not sure if I'm going to play the next two in a row or not. These are both very short, just about 2 or 3 minutes each. But this next one is something that, it's an example of, we just gathered all of these human stories and this news event happened. And we describe it very briefly in the beginning of this StoryCorps. So this is just 3 minutes. Most of the StoryCorps are about just 3 minutes.
Time now for StoryCorps, the project recording conversations between families and loved ones. Today we'll hear from a young man named Samuel Taylor. When he was 15 years old, Samuel told his mother, Connie Casey, that he was gay. She sent him to a series of conversion ministries associated with Exodus International, a self-described Christian ministry that promoted reparative therapy for homosexuals. Last week, the group shut down and apologized for trying to, quote, correct same-sex attractions. Samuel and his mom recently sat down for StoryCorps to talk about that experience.
You feel like being gay is like a virus. It's like, you have to get rid of this because this is what you're doomed for. And I remember, I thought, letting me, of course, behave like a straight man.
At the time that you came out, I blamed myself. You know, it's because I'm a single parent mom and I don't know how to raise a son and there needs to be a man around here. Somehow I did this to you and now you were going to be relegated to a life of horror.
Those couple of years were very hard for both of us.
Your first year of college when you went away to school and came back and we had this conversation again was the first time that I really felt in my heart that it was time to take a look at everything that I'd ever been taught to believe.
I can just be completely honest. I didn't care at that point whether you accepted me or not. But it ended up being more important than I thought it would. When I had come home sophomore year, I saw on the fridge a magnet. And on the magnet was a rainbow heart that says, "Love is spoken here." And so, you know, what kind of advice could you give to a parent who has not come to that same conclusion?
I guess the overriding feeling is that no matter how strongly you think you believe something, at the end of the day, you just always have to love and accept your kid. It's non-negotiable, as far as I'm concerned.
I don't think I've ever told you that I completely and 100% forgive you. It's part of what we had to go through to get to where we are today. And for that, I'm not only forgiven, I am grateful.
If this were to be the last 5 minutes of conversation that I've got to have with you, and I think you already know these things, but it doesn't hurt to say it again, I'm so sorry, and I could not be more proud of the human being that you are. You're just an amazing, awesome human being.
Connie Casey speaking in StoryCorps with her 22-year-old son, Samuel Taylor, who went through what some call conversion therapy with the now-defunct Exodus International. Their conversation will be archived at the Library of Congress, and you can get the podcast at npr.org.
Time again for StoryCorps, the project recording conversations between loved ones. Today we'll hear from Tony Perry, who sat down with his 20-year-old grandson, Jeffrey. In the early 1970s, Tony was a married man living with Jeffrey's grandmother and their children. Then Tony told his wife that he was gay. It was something that he'd been advised not to share years earlier.
I remember when I was about 17, I went to confess and told a priest that I thought there was something a little different to me, that I was attracted to men, and the only advice he gave me was, be careful who you tell that to, son. So I didn't tell anybody for another 17 years. And the next person I told that to the priest was your grandmother. I could not, in all good conscience, stay in the marriage. It wasn't fair to grandma, it wasn't fair to the children, it wasn't fair to me. And one thing your grandmother had asked me to do when we separated was, please never tell the children. But there reached a period of time that I had to really sit down with each of the kids and just say the word gay, I am gay. But coming out to you was probably the most proudest moment I've ever had. You were 9 years old and Uncle John and I had just split up and you came to visit me. You had asked, where did Uncle John sleep? So I was very honest with you and said, you know, Uncle John and I share in a room. Yeah. I remember you asking me, does Grandma Shirley know you're gay? Does Grandma know you're gay? Does my mother know you're gay? And I didn't lie to you. And that's what I've strived for all my life, just to live honestly. And many years I did not, even though I love Grandma Shirley very much and I love being a father, I just felt I was not living an honest life.
You know, I like to tell people that you paved the way for me, but came out of the closet, the first person to know wasn't you, Papa. I was, I think, afraid of, you know, what you would think. Would you be afraid for me? I was
very real, you know.
Yeah, so I did tell you right away. But I'm so lucky to have you in my life. You are my role model, and it's a privilege to have you as a grandma.
I love you. I love you too.
Toby Perry with his grandson Jeffrey Perry in Rochester, New York. Their conversation will be archived at the Library of Congress along with all StoryCorps interviews. Subscribe to the project's podcast at npr.org.
So those two were, you know, related by theme, but the first one I like to play because it's an example of how if you collect enough stories, you'll, you know, the news will, well, people make the news, and so you will get some things that play off the news. And I would say that this happens 3 out of 4 of these per month, that there is something that has happened within the last few days that we can play a story core that just gives you a little human element of a bigger national drama. And I would go back and forth on playing that second one just now because I'm very conflicted about that story. I feel like there's so much more that we don't know that isn't part of it. And you can tell that from each of these stories. These interviews go on sometimes for 15 minutes, as with Danny and Annie. They came back time and time and time again, and I think there are like 4 or 5 hours of interviews with them. And then we edit them down to these little 3-minute stories, and everything that's there is true, but not everything that's true is there. And so that's a rule in journalism. Everything you say has to be true, but not everything that's true gets to be said because you spend hours interviewing somebody and you want to take the best 2 or 3 minutes to share it with, you know, the 27 million people who hear NPR's programming. Does anybody have anything that they wanted to add about either of those pieces?
So when you go to the archives, you can get the whole story.
The Library of Congress archives the whole interview. When you go to our website, you don't have access to the whole interview. But you could go. I don't think that the Library of Congress has put everything online. I'm pretty sure they haven't. So what's available to you is what's available on as it was broadcast.
That makes me curious. Because obviously there's wonderful editing that's going on. But you're shaping the story.
Right.
You shape a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Right.
And I'm wondering how much is lost in the, or somehow morphed, that the listener thinks all things happen that way. Mm-hmm. That they think that this was an easy beginning, middle, end. Or that this is the way my story ought to go. And how much you miss by not having the noise that
right.
you edit out.
Right. I think you do miss a lot of the noise. This is why I think that I don't think they need to teach driver's ed as much as I think they need to teach media education in high schools. Because I think that all stories come out this way. I'm going to play a piece later in the week in the fourth session, which is all about how human beings understand stories and how we tell stories. Everybody believes that memory is like a tape recorder or a videotape, and that you experience something because you can think, you remember it as if it's happening as a videotape, but that's not how memory works. Memories are this, Joan Didion refers to it as this phantasmagoria, and what the writer does is freeze it and tell a story about it. And we all tell ourselves stories about ourselves. And the more you tell the story about the time, my grandmother used to tell this story about how her father picked her up when a cow was running at her on the dairy farm and pulled her over the fence. And she told it so many times over my life, but I always noticed that it changed a little bit. And until I started writing as a journalist, I didn't realize that, oh, well, that's how memory works. It's not a videotape in your mind. It's sort of an explosion of neurons that are sort of fired in a certain sequence that help you understand the story. But in telling the story about yourself, you create the story. I'm going to play a piece about neuroscience and that how that works and how Virginia Woolf figured it out before neuroscientists did later in the week. Because Mrs. Dalloway is all about learning to tell a story about yourself. But I think you're right. Not only do people have great control over the stories they tell about themselves, but when they share those stories with journalists, the journalists have great control. You talk to somebody for an hour, and we shape it down into 3 or 4 minutes. That happens every week with StoryCorps, and it happens 20 times a day on Morning Edition and 20 times a day on All Things Considered. Now, oral histories are a little different than straightforward journalism in that I'll play some pieces later in the week that are sort of talking to multiple sources and shaping. What you get is, you know, 4 different people telling you the story of what happened, and you're then turning that into one story for your listeners. So you're sort of acting like the brain of somebody trying to take all these different events and tell a story based on it. Oral history is different in that you're generally asking one person to tell their story. When I was in college, I spent a summer working at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum doing oral history interviews of survivors. And one of the processes we went through was that each interviewer would spend a long time, like a week or more, just reading about the city that the person was from or the concentration camps that we knew they had been to, so that we would know something about the story they were going to tell us. And then we'd sit down and interview them for 4 or 5 hours. We had this sort of set lists of questions. And then we would go back a month later and ask them the same stories. And they were always very different. And sometimes, you know, I just remember this one instance. I was telling somebody about this earlier today. This woman from a certain town in Poland was convinced that she had gone from this town to, I don't remember the name of the concentration camp, Treblinka, but everybody from that town actually went to Birkenau. And she was convinced that it was Treblinka, but it was actually in the wrong part of the country to be Treblinka. And we have all sorts of records, because the Nazis were very good at keeping records of where they sent people. So it was, in fact, we have records that show she didn't go to the place she always thought she went to. Now, she wasn't lying to me. She just truly thought that's where she went. And she also told me that she had certainly seen Dr. Mengele, but we knew exactly where Dr. Mengele was because, again, Nazis were very good at keeping records. And so the story that she told had all of these factual errors. And part of my job was to not only interview her, but then when these stories would come back from the transcriptionist, to go in and annotate them, put this little asterisk, and then like write a footnote that explained that, well, we actually know that, and we have records that show that she didn't go from this place to this other place, but she went from this city to this concentration camp, and that she probably didn't see Dr. Mengele, but she probably saw this other doctor who we have records of being at that camp at that time. I think the difference between oral history and family stories is that ethic of verification and fact-checking and making sure that the story is as true as we can make it. And I think that that's something that journalists get a lot of flack for doing. When I was here for the film festival in February, I ended up being, I think, the bad guy quite a lot when we were watching some of the documentaries, because I was asking some of the filmmakers, well, did you verify any of these things that these people told you? You know, and did you, like, look up records? Did you find his arrest records? Did you find his prison records? And they said, no. And I said, well, this isn't necessarily in a documentary. It's just like his story that he told you. But it may or may not be true. And part of what we do as journalists is try to tell the truest story possible, or at least the most factually true story possible. You don't do that necessarily to catch people in lies, although when you're fact-checking, you quite often do catch people in lies. But sometimes people just misremember, or the story they've been telling themselves for these 40 years is not actually what happened, but the story that they got a little bit wrong the first time and 10 things wrong by the 10th telling, and 40 years later, the story bears very little resemblance to what actually happened. So it's our job as journalists and people who actually do sort of real oral histories to fact-check that stuff. And then you can actually go back, and when I went back to interview the woman who got all the names of the concentration camps wrong, it's a very touchy task to Either are you correcting somebody about which concentration camp they went to? That you are a shitty person. So, you know, you sort of say, well, you know, we have these records that show you went from here to here, and it turns out like there were certain things she fought me on, but one thing was like, oh my God, you're right. I've been telling this story wrong for 60 years. It's just needed somebody to like look up the facts. So, I want to play one more piece for you. But did anybody have any other thoughts? Play one more piece. So the first five. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. The ones you've played so far, even though like in all the stories there's like a lot of trauma and like secrets and like really hard things, and like, you know, in the one the like guy dies and it's very sad, but they all like sort of end like and like the people are resolved in them, and I'm wondering, and I haven't listened to enough storyboard to maybe know, do you ever get people who their conversations like they're not reconciled?
Yeah.
Or like can you really get two people in a booth to do that? I don't know.
Yeah. I think that a lot of them are not reconciled, and we don't broadcast tons of those, but we do broadcast some of those. The ones that are still open are there's too much left. They're not satisfying, and good stories should have some sort of, I think anyway, I mean, I'm not very modernist in this way, but I think a good story should have some sort of sense of satisfaction at the end. A lot of the pieces that I edit are very constructed to be sad, and I would say this to people that I'm editing, and I say, like, this doesn't end in a really satisfying way. Like, go back and re-interview them and find out what really happened, or make it make meaning, because that's your job. But, you know, and some of these stories, you know, we edit them to be satisfying. Mm-hmm. There are moments of satisfaction, and we manipulate the material in order to make, you know, we take a person's whole life and we cut it down into 3 minutes and then try to share it with people. There's a lot of manipulation to what we do. I want to play one more piece for you, which is not part of the StoryCorps project, but part of some independent producer pros called the Kitchen Sisters, who do a lot of something like oral history. And we did a series called Hidden Kitchens a few years ago. And this is my favorite Hidden Kitchen. It was basically about the surprising places kitchens show up in our lives. And the story, I don't want to set it up any more than that because it needs to speak for itself.
Our Hidden Kitchen series returns this morning. Over the past year, we opened up a phone line and asked listeners to tell us their stories about unsung kitchen heroes, local kitchen rituals, and visionaries. We've heard about freighter food on the Great Lakes, kitchens tucked away in the racing pits of NASCAR, and a midnight stew made in Kentucky. Today, the Kitchen Sisters, Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson, bring us a story that was left on the Hidden Kitchens hotline last summer about a kitchen that is truly clandestine, started in a Louisiana prison.
Message 24 was received at 7 a.m. today.
My name is Arissa Arendt. I live in New Orleans. I have a friend who created the most amazing kitchen. His name is Robert King Wilkerson. He was in prison at Angola State Penitentiary for 31 years. 29 of those years he was in solitary confinement. He was a Black Panther, started a chapter of the Black Panther Party with two of his friends. They've sort of become a cause celeb, known as the Angola Three. Somehow, in solitary confinement, he managed to create a kitchen, and he made pralines, which we love here in New Orleans. He's out now. They decided they had made a mistake for locking him up for so long. He had a new trial, and he sells his candies that he calls pralines, and they are really, really good.
I'm fascinated with sugar. I used to watch Mom make candy with pecans and sugar and water. But it wasn't until some years later, when I first went to prison, I was cooking in the kitchen. This guy was in the bakery. He could bake all kinds of pastries, make all kinds of candy. I was fascinated with the candy. What I saw before my eyes was like a science being revealed. My name is Robert K. Wilson. We used to get milk, I had to grab a bag of butter and sugar. They would put it on the tray where they could drink coffee now. So I used to get the guys to save the sugar. Sometimes I was fortunate enough to get pecans. They got a lot of pecan trees around Angola. And we had some officers, once it tasted candy, making sure I had pecans. We would bribe the order. Sometimes we'd get a fruit cane, peach cane, but most of the time it was cocaine. They were easy to get. Just peel the top. And then peel another cane, trip it up, maybe 18 inches long, and that toilet paper, roll it up, and turn it into like a bundle. I was definitely in. They would come in and conduct a shakedown and get the pot, get the cane and everything else, then write you up. I'm kind of enjoying the thrill, going outside the box a little bit, making candy, and then giving it away, you know. Especially the guys on the network, because I just wanted them to have something that they hadn't had in a long time.
Good afternoon, this is KLSP 91.7 FM. Every broadcast daily from the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola. I'd like to take this opportunity to wish y'all a little brothers up on death row. A very beautiful day, I tell you what.
King was released in 2001. On the very first day he's released, he's making candy. He was sitting there just stirring real slowly. Sugar candy. Freelanes is what he calls them.
I call them freelanes. I mean, I wanted them to rhyme with pralines. When I first got out, I went in French Quarter and I went through every candy shop and I thought I could do better. That is what I say, I guess, perfected a candy while I was in prison.
He uses it for a fundraiser. When he goes to events, political organizing events, a lot of times he'll bring some candy. And so that's kind of been the way that he's made some pocket change. It's been really important to him because after 30 years of solitary confinement, it's not that easy to just go out and get a regular job. My name is Ann Harkness. I'm an activist and have been King's pecan supplier pretty much since he got out of prison. Everywhere he goes, he'll just bust out and some candy made him.
My name is Malik Brown, co-founder of Common Ground Relief and resident of New Orleans and the community of Algiers. King and I was raised together. His backyard was adjacent to my backyard. Freelance is something that he's doing to subsidize his income. That's the only option that really he had is by making candy. On his wrapper is not just no logo of King. It's Freelance Gold Decree about his two comrades that are still incarcerated. He's always looked at that injustice. His kitchen will reflect this.
Some of the dirtiest toxic soup you can imagine. Reporting in New Orleans.
It was a few days before Katrina. I had made that game. That was the last time. I couldn't get into the Superdome, but there was no place to keep a dog. Kenny, his name my dog. I got him and she fit in the palm of my hand, you know. So I elected to hold tight. There were some people who came by in boats. We exchanged food. I gave losing candy when there were dogs screaming and who had been locked up in the house. My neighbor next door had to break in the house. But I sealed it back up. I had to go in and feed her dogs. She had two and I had to fight them to feed them. And I had been in the world twice to save two boys whose wings had gotten wet. I was learning about so much death and devastation that was going around me. I felt imperative that I saved a life. I think I cried more in those 16 days that I was in the house after Katrina than I did in 31 years I did in prison. It not only took so much away from me as an individual, it replicated this hundreds of thousands of times. I think candy is a collateral. My going wasn't doing, keeping focus on the injustices that were taking place in Angola. If doing so by cooking, making candy, opening up kitchens can produce money to aid them, so be it. Maybe that's my calling.
Ann
find the recipe at NPR.org. King's Candy, a New Orleans kitchen vision, was produced by the Kitchen Sisters. On Monday, we'll have a conversation with Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva about their new book, Hidden Kitchens, inspired by this series. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
So that one is considerably different than the others in that it wasn't two friends talking to each other, but the Kitchen Sisters, who are documentary radio makers, interviewing, starts with a phone call, and then they go out and interview. And knowing the Kitchen Sisters, they probably interviewed these people for like 20 hours, and then turned it into, that was about 7 minutes of radio, where you hear four elements. You hear the phone call, then the candy maker, then the woman in the phone call comes back into the story, not on the phone anymore, and then the guy at the end. So it's a different, I actually like the StoryCorps model because I think you're getting more sort of, journalists get authentic stories, but you're getting more intimate stories told because you don't have to quickly do this sort of accelerated version of intimacy because you have actual friends and family members talking to each other. It takes much longer, and sometimes the reason that the interview goes on for, you know, three interviews over 4 days is to get something like intimacy between the people telling each other stories. So that's it for the night, for tonight. I have something. Tomorrow's session will be about asking questions, and I have some things here that you could, I only made 5 copies of each because I had no idea how many were here, but they're all very short, so you could all split them up and, you know, read them at the, you know, someplace between 4 and 10 pages. So I'll unclip them and you can take these with you and read them for tomorrow. Or you don't have to read them if you don't want to, but you can come and just listen tomorrow. Tomorrow we're gonna listen to some of my favorite excerpts of interviews, most of which have been on Fresh Air, since that's my favorite show. And everything from sort of fun and funny interviews to very serious interviews. So that's tomorrow. Thank you for coming tonight.
Thank you.